All right, welcome to the Wheelhouse. I never know quite what I'm supposed to do, but I know I'm supposed to start talking at a certain point. This is Colin McEnroe. John Dankosky is off for this week and last week. He is, of course, at a Renaissance fair in Spain. We have some pretty exciting news about that, too. Mrs. Dankosky finished second in women's jousting. So they're coming back with some hardware. It's not just a bunch of people doing Morris dancing and pretending to be wizards. Although I think there's also quite a bit of that. All right, so joining us today, well, first of all, Caitlin Krasselt, Rookie of the Year in Connecticut Political Reporting, political reporter at Hearst Connecticut Media, will be joining us. But poor Caitlin, who can probably hear my voice right now, is stuck in traffic, which will be alleviated as soon as the Larson Tunnel is built. Up, here she is. She made it. She's in here. She took the Larson Tunnel. They just opened up a little piece of the tunnel so she could get here. But she's just walking in the door. Meanwhile, Russell Blair, reporter on the Hartford Courant's Mentor Desk. No, that's an old title. You're something fancier than that,
aren't
you?
A content editor, as you called it.
You're a content editor. That's right. He's a very content, he's a content editor. Jonathan Wharton, assistant professor of political science and urban affairs at Southern Connecticut State University. I would like to note that his Twitter handle is Preppy Prof.
And also, I noticed on the way in this morning, his license plate is Prof.
So. Oh, God. Thanks for advertising that.
I'm obliged to disclose that Jonathan is working as a consultant or something on the Republican controller candidate Kurt Miller's campaign. So probably won't be talking too much about the controller race today. So what we are going to begin with, first of all, deep cleansing breath.
I made it.
Now we can't, talk badly about you.
All right. So so take those headphones off and put other headphones on. You people who are listening, you're getting to see the fourth wall torn down here. And this is almost like a tradition. The person puts on the wrong pair of headphones, and we make them put on another pair of headphones.
Okay.
All right. So while she gets comfortable, Jonathan, I'm going to have you kick us off a little bit, particularly because, you know, one thing that we don't talk about too much on the Wheelhouse, just because there are not competitive races, are four of the five congressional seats and the U.S. Senate seat. All of the above are in play this year. But as we looked around the country and looked across some of our actual state borders, we saw Democratic insurgencies where long-time, long-serving incumbent members of Congress found themselves challenged from within their party, usually by somebody younger, often by somebody of color, generally by somebody more progressive ideologically than said incumbent was. So why doesn't this happen in Connecticut? I mean, like, nobody even whispers about taking on any of the four people who are sitting in seats they already hold.
I think it's a tough bet to take on. I mean, first off, these incumbents have been there for years. Secondly, their war chests are significant, and they often give money to each other. It's amazing, especially in terms of the support you saw from Murphy, for example. But you do have to remember, of course, with Estes Cissrick there, you did see kind of a shakeup because obviously Glassman was that endorsed candidate after May's convention for the Democrats. But then we saw obviously who won at the end of the day was Hayes. So, you know, I think there is somewhat of an interest, but to challenge that, it's almost impossible to do so.
Yeah, I mean, although, you know, Russell, in a way, to say that they've been sitting there for a long time is absolutely true. But, I mean, it kind of – there's some other explanation. I mean, you know, Joe Crowley or whatever his name was sitting there for a long time before – I mean, one of the differences, some of these other districts in New York and Massachusetts, the actual constituency has changed. That may be one part of an explanation.
Yeah, no, I think you're seeing, you know, districts where, you know, there's a majority Latino, for example, population, majority African-American population, and they're looking at the people that are representing them in Congress, and, you know, those people don't look like them. And I think that's a big piece of this is that, you know, we're seeing in other places across the country these majority-minority districts, if you will, where a lot of times, you know, for lack of a better term, it's an old white guy that's representing those people's interests, and maybe they feel like there isn't that connection there. You know, what's interesting in Connecticut, you know, John Larson, the congressman representing, you know, Hartford, you know, again, is, for lack of a better term, an old white guy, but he seems to be doing, you know, pretty well. There hasn't been anybody that's made a lot of effort to try to primary him. As Jonathan said, you know, our congressional incumbents raise millions and millions of dollars. And you know, when if you're somebody that even if you think you have a credible campaign, a wedge issue, a way that you could mount an offensive against somebody in a primary, it's a huge uphill battle. And we've seen some success in other parts of the country where people have made these, you know, viral videos, you know, gone to the internet for marketing and reached out and gotten donations from across the country. We haven't seen it here yet, but I think that, you know, next cycle, two cycles from now, you know, Connecticut could be the next place where we see a candidate like that.
Let me add to what he just offered, too, because I neglected to include, we did see a challenge, at least in New Haven, because Brian Anderson, who's obviously, you know, a councilman and alderman there in Milford, did try to challenge Rosa DeLauro and, of course, proved to be unsuccessful. Again, right. Going back to your main point, it takes a lot to fundraise. And for him, it was very challenging for him to do so. And he's an African-American gay man.
I didn't even know that happened.
Yeah. A lot of people didn't know that happened.
I think that was probably the problem.
Was he just seized by guys in, you know, a black SUV, and now he's like living on a farm somewhere. Well, actually, Caitlin, I'm going to ask you a very unscripted question about this, which is you're from Idaho originally.
Yes.
You've lived other places. You're a relatively recent transplant to Connecticut. I mean, you know, we actually are known as the land of steady habits. There's even a new movie on Netflix with that title. There's a way in which maybe – is it possible, and you've got a fresh set of eyes on the Connecticut temperament, that we're just not obstreperous enough to, you know, take a really hard shot at a Larson or a Courtney or a DeLauro or a Himes?
I think that you have the advantage of having these moderate Democrats, and they're not seeing a challenge – from the right or the left. Something that stands out to me about Connecticut is that Connecticut Republicans would be Democrats where I'm from. So to me, you have these people.
I'm kind of offended by that.
Yeah. No, but it's true. I mean, like, to hear Joe Markley is seen as, you know, kind of an extremist, and where I'm from, it would just be the norm. Right. So to me, that's what stands out about Connecticut, and I think that plays into why these people don't necessarily have challengers, is that they get into office, they have the war chest and the support, and they're kind of doing what everyone expects them to do. And so,
well, yeah. I think also, I mean, it's also possible when we talk about Boston or New York City, Russell, we're talking about places where you could, I mean, you might have a strong urban political machine, but you also have a big talent base too. You've got a bunch of people who could come forward and say, you know, within this urban district. I mean, our districts aren't specifically urban, right? I mean, Rosa DeLauro has New Haven in her district. She's got a lot of other stuff in her district. Same with Larson. You know, his district isn't Hartford. Mm-hmm. You know, it's Hartford and a bunch of suburbs. And that might make it easier to keep the kind of insurgent who's risen up in some of these other places out of the picture.
Yeah, I think that, you know, he represents a broad constituency of people. You know, it's the cities, it's the suburbs, and it's not – you know, it's hard to find one singular issue or one singular focus, you know, to run a campaign on if you're looking at, you know, the primary challenge. One thing I think is interesting, I think it was either, I can't remember if it was the Washington Post or the New York Times, but they did a story and they looked at Democratic congressional incumbents that have gone the longest without a primary. And this goes to the whole point of this topic. But I think it was DeLauro and Larson were right up there as, you know, Democrats that have gone the longest without facing a primary challenger. So, you know, maybe part of it is the Connecticut land of steady habits. But I think part of it also is the liberal groups in Connecticut that kind of got awakened after Donald Trump got elected in 2016. I think they're really just kind of starting to get their sea legs. You know, some of them are running for state office this time. But I think in 2 years, I think in 4 years, those people that got their training from Indivisible, that went to the Women's March, and that was kind of where they got their political start, those people might look at our congressional delegation and say, you know, if someone like, you know, it's a small example, but if someone like Jillian Gilchrist in West Hartford can beat an Andy Fleischman, mm-hmm. who's been there for 20 plus years, what's to say I can't go out there and try to take on someone like Larson or DeLauro?
Andy right. Fleischman. I mean, I'm from West Hartford, so I remember that name very well.
But Andy, who's a good friend of mine and, yeah. and also my state representative right mm-hmm. now, he's like the only example. The reason right. that we keep reaching for Andy as an example is he's the only example of an incumbent Democrat who, in this August 14th primary that I don't know of, you cover the legislature, maybe you know somebody else, but it seems to me that there were some fights over some open seats and stuff, but they you know, even if you reach down that far, forget about Congress or U.S. Senator, state rep, state senator, very difficult to get these people out.
Yeah, I actually don't really cover the state legislature.
So, I made that up.
So I'm just, you know, following.
Actually, while you were stuck in traffic, you got a new job.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Fun. but as far as I know, that's the only example that's been brought up. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I will just quickly tell a story from 2006 that involves one of the candidates for governor right now. This is when Ned Lamont was primarying Joe Lieberman. And I was on primary night sort of back in the vote counting room with one of his campaign managers, David Pudlin. And as the votes started to pile up, David Pudlin, in his particular way of speaking, looked at me and he said, you know, to get one of these people, one of these incumbent senators, once they're in here, to get them out, you really have to catch them in maybe a combination of, you know, a sex scandal and a financial scandal. We may be about to evict an incumbent senator based on his policies. That's almost un-American. That's sort of stuck with me for a long time. But Jonathan, one of the things that happens in that situation is if you don't have to run a competitive race, if you're Jim Himes, if you're Chris Murphy, you, as you suggested before, can pile up insane amounts of cash.
Yes.
And then suddenly you're Uncle Moneybags.
Absolutely. And then the best part is that if you are trying to challenge someone, or even, you know, at the federal level, you can support and get their support. You can get the consultants. You can get their money. You can find all kinds of pathways to doing that. You saw that with Johanna Hayes. She leaned a lot on Chris Murphy, obviously, and proved to be successful. Of course, I love the whole part that Chris Murphy didn't endorse her, you know, publicly, you know, didn't want to shake things up with Glassman. So, but that's a classic example of what I'm talking about.
It's also sort of a classic example of Chris Murphy. But what were you
going to say? Well, I was going to add in, we talked about viral videos. I mean, she had a perfect example of that. I mean, I had people, you know, out west who know me that I live here. They're like, hey, this person's running for Congress in your state. And I was like, yeah, I know.
Yeah. And she wound up getting small donations from all over the place.
And I think she hasn't had TV advertising since the primary, if I remember correctly.
But she's very good on Twitter, though. Yeah. She's got quite the Twitter presence and social media.
I think people from Idaho sent her a frozen trout.
That's
how much they liked her video.
She's also a Southern alum, by the way. So they're promoting her a lot at my college.
But this, you know, Russell, this has allowed Chris Murphy in particular to, A, be a big player nationally because he can, you know, whip out $10,000 for various campaigns all around the country. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Chris Murphy. And here in Connecticut, I mean, he is, I think, becoming something akin to, not in a negative way, sort of a political boss. I mean, yeah, Johanna Hayes is the person that he located and decided to put his team into. And I mean, I don't know. There, right now, isn't anybody who has a bigger footprint or casts a bigger shadow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly there's a governor's race this year, but you could argue that, you know, Chris Murphy is going to be the Democratic candidate that gets the most votes. I mean, he sort of is the de facto head of the party right now in the state, you know, with Governor Malloy departing. Murphy's up for re-election this year. One thing that he's done is set up this infrastructure called Fight Back Connecticut. And it's not specifically his campaign, but what they're doing is using, you know, his campaign funds and doing a massive Democratic get out the vote effort. And, you know, we have some pretty strict campaign finance laws, but you're allowed to, at least for, you know, quote unquote, get out the vote efforts, he can go and help in canvass for Democratic candidates up and down the ballot. And we've already seen that. You know, he's got these field coordinators that are out there. They're knocking on doors in legislative races. And, you know, I think this is something that, you know, if you're a Republican running for, you know, state rep in Manchester, for example, you got to be worried that, you know, Chris Murphy could come in and a couple of field organizers that, you know, he's helping to pay for could come into your district and knock doors and distribute literature and all that kind of thing. So, you know, it's a tremendous tremendous advantage for Democrats, not just, you know, statewide, but also in some of these local races. And, you know, we haven't talked about it a lot, but control of the legislature this year is going to be key, whoever the next governor is. So Chris Murphy going to be helping out a lot with that.
But in reality, this is really no different, maybe a little different in some ways, than what you see in the tri-state area. I mean, I studied a lot, for example, in Newark in terms of what's going on with Cory Booker and what Sharp James did to create a very similar kind of infrastructure internally with this political campaign to knock out people who weren't supportive of his administration when he was trying to, you know, run again for mayor. It worked successfully in some ways, but it can also be a backlash. I also worked for Charlie Rangel for a while back in the 90s, and he had quite a war chest. And often, he would support a lot of candidates financially and politically, and he didn't really need that money, millions of dollars in his war chest, but he could give the money to these candidates. And so what Chris Murphy is doing is not that unusual. I would only say that in terms of what you're saying, Russell, he has become kind of the de facto now Democratic leader in light of Malloy.
You know, Caitlin Himes, who's down your way, is kind of interesting example. Some different things are going on with him. First of all, that used to be, back in the day, a much tippier district. Of course, it belonged to Republicans like Stu McKinney and Chris Shays for a long time. It seems like a solid Democratic district, maybe even drifting to the left a little bit. And he's kind of positioned himself, at least within Congress, as kind of the opposite of an Ocasio-Cortez, right? He's sort of Mr. Tap the Brakes, let's keep things – let's not get too crazy here. Let's not do like Medicare for All or something like that.
Yes, but I think he does support that, if I remember correctly. But yeah, he is kind of leading this moderate Democrat faction, and it's, you're right, he's from Greenwich, where you've seen the rise of like indivisible Greenwich, and they're becoming more progressive. But he is this Wall Street guy who's kind of, you know, he's moderate on.
He's sort of the old Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, exactly. He falls very well in the middle, and so DLC. He is lending his support to a lot of candidates across the country in districts where Hillary won, but they have been, those seats have been held by Republicans. And so, his support is going to helping in Congress. And I think that will be really interesting to see how that plays out.
But you almost have to be. I mean, I worked for Christopher Shays as well in the 90s, and you have to be in that district, whether Republican or Democrat. You've got to be a centrist in many ways.
Yeah.
Because the constituency, it's a swing district. It can be. Yeah. It really has the potential to be again. Mm-hmm. And I would not rule out a good kind of Republican upset at some point.
Not this time, though.
The demographics of the area are just, they play into.
But you have to remember back in 2008 when Chris Shays got knocked out, it was because of Barack Obama.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Obama. Yeah. And that's why Shays got knocked out. So don't forget that. Bridgeport showed up.
Yeah.
And if you see the election numbers, it's quite amazing to see that. When they get awakened, watch out. So it is an interesting district to kind of study there.
So, but as we head into this November, Russell, I mean, it is kind of interesting to think about coming out on the other side. 538 now rates a 5 out of 6 chance that the Democrats will take back control of the House, only about a 1/3 chance that the Senate will tip back to Democrats. But I mean, you know, once again, Larson has in the past been a high-ranking person in leadership. Himes is positioning himself in a certain way. Although, I mean, it's insane to try to predict what will happen, because I think there are going to be some real fights that involve some of these much more progressive new people who are going to get elected. But Connecticut members of Congress are going to play some kind of significant role.
Yeah, I mean, nobody, in the delegation is up for a chairmanship if it goes Democratic. But certainly, Jim Himes is the number two person on the Intelligence Committee. So he's certainly going to be a player there. John Larson has been on the Ways and Means Committee for a long time now. That's a very powerful committee there. So we have some people. I know Chris Murphy, not that the Senate tips necessarily, but you know, he's on appropriations. So we have some people that are on important committees for the state in terms of bringing money back home. We also have people that are on some important committees in terms of, you know, national policy, whether it's taxes, whether it's health care. We haven't gotten into it yet, but, you know, John Larson's plan for the tunnel tunnels to bury the highways in Hartford, I-91 and I-84. One of the things he has pointed out is that, you know, if Congress goes Democratic, I'm on the Ways and Means Committee. Maybe I can help to drive this thing home.
Monorail. We might as well segue a little bit to the tunnel here. Caitlin wishes like anything there were a tunnel. She was having a hard time getting up here from the south. Let's listen to Luke Bronin. This is from one of many kind of public forum conversations about the – I feel like there have been other tunnel forums, but it's maybe what passes for nightlife right now in Hartford, the tunnel forum. This is the mayor, Luke Bronin, talking a little bit about this. This audio is courtesy of Max Reese. It's from Max Reese's personal collection. No, it's actually courtesy of –
The city was built as a riverfront city, and I think one of the biggest mistakes of the last century was severing the city from the river. So I think there's enormous possibilities for economic development, for recreation, for improving quality of life.
The thing is, Caitlin, the whole purpose of this forum was to have a whole bunch of people from Seattle show up and talk about how they built the tunnel. Although, really, by the time they were through talking, it seemed like they were the wrong people to bring in. They said, look, there isn't as much federal money around for this kind of stuff. You know, and Redeker, the Department of Transportation head for the Malloy administration, you kind of tell he doesn't like this idea either. But you have some firsthand or first headlight knowledge of the Seattle Tunnel Project. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I grew up in the Northwest. They have been building that tunnel. It's supposed to be done, I believe, this fall. It was supposed to take 2 to 2.5 years, and that started in 2013. So as you can see, it did not go as planned. They had one of their boring machines get stuck. It was this huge scandal. It was named Bertha after, I believe, a former mayor of Seattle, and it was just chaos. And that project, by my understanding and from listening to the forum the other night, that project was projected to be simpler than a similar project here would be. And so because right. you have that interchange and right. it's not just a parallel tunnel. So it would be interesting.
Right. By the way, when she says boring machines, she means the kind of things that drill into the ground. When you use the word boring in Hartford, you have to be very careful that you're
not describing the nightlife.
Right. I apologize.
We're just kidding about the nightlife. The nightlife is fine. I've been out having the nightlife. It's fine. There's nothing wrong with the nightlife.
Still rooting for New Haven.
Yeah. But I don't know, Russell. I mean, it's a complicated time. Larson Cephas safe for all the reasons we said. He can say anything he wants. But Pork doesn't really have the greatest reputation right now. I mean, I just kind of wonder whether waving this thing around right now, particularly as if everybody knows it's going to be just hell during construction and maybe worse than hell. People will move to hell because the taxes are lower and they don't have this.
And it's warmer down there, too.
Right.
is that Florida?
One thing about this that I thought was a little interesting was I noticed part of the whole forum was paid for by Larson's reelection campaign. Mm-hmm. So you got to take it with a little bit
Good
of a
point.
Grain of salt. And also, I think his argument all along has been he first brought this up before the election, I think 2 years ago. And his point is, he said, look, if they're going to do big infrastructure projects, why don't we have a huge infrastructure project that we can bring to the Trump administration and say, look, here's our idea. Here's our $50 billion plan. And, his thing was basically, look, you got to have a big idea. What's wrong with a big idea? And yeah, there's, I guess there's something to be said for that of having a big plan. But I think how quickly, even the Connecticut DOT has kind of poo-pooed this, it shows that there's a lot of thinking that needs to go into something like this. I know there was concerns about emergency vehicles getting through the tunnel. Could you imagine if there was a crash in the tunnel on rush hour coming into Hartford on a Monday morning or something like that, how much worse the traffic would be? So, the concept might seem like this great thing, but as Caitlin pointed out, these projects can go over budget. They can take much longer. This is, 5-10 times the project that Seattle did. You're basically burying the entire I-91, I-84 interchange. All the flyovers, all that stuff has somehow got to get put underground in a tunnel or multiple tunnels. It's a nice idea to think about or to look at renderings, but I think, practically it would be, quite possibly the biggest construction project Connecticut has ever done.
Right.
So this is actually my wheelhouse, Colin, because I study urban development.
No, this
so,
is the wheelhouse.
Oh, yeah, I know. So you get two for one. But the thing is that, I study urban development projects, and it is quite amazing to see sometimes the layering of government, the tax initiatives, the grants, the money that goes into something like this. But usually it's done for much bigger cities than Hartford. Hartford is not Seattle. It is not Boston. This is a much smaller, quote-unquote, secondary city. We're dealing with only a population of, 140,000, 150,000 people here? I think we need to find a better way of growing out Hartford to really call for this and be taken seriously by the federal government. And I just don't see the merit of doing this right now. If they had some kind of grand plan and saying that they're going to redevelop downtown significantly, and of course there's some ideas out there what they're trying to do with downtown south and all the issues that come along with that stadium and the grocery store and the condo and whatever, they need to do more projects like that and actually come to fruition and it comes in on time to call for something like this. I just don't see any real merit to doing this project.
I think to follow
actually, it's actually downtown north. So you are from New Haven.
It's downtown north. I am. God, I am.
You got a pretty bridge. You got that nice pretty bridge. You won't let us have no tunnel.
Well, blame Rosa DeLauro for that.
just to follow up on what Jonathan was saying, I think one point that I think about with this is I don't know where the developers are necessarily that are clamoring to redevelop the Hartford Riverfront. I think right. you could do a right. lot there, but I don't see private developers that really want to invest all that money until you get that piece of it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You got to sort of put the brakes on this.
All right. Speaking of putting the brakes on, we're going to do that. We're going to go to a break, and we're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit about gubernatorial debates. I should mention that the Wheelhouse today is on Facebook Live. So if you go on Facebook Live I should go on the Wheelhouse page. Is it on the Wheelhouse page or is it on the Connecticut Public page? I'll get some information about that. But anyway, the whole idea is that you can watch actually all the panelists look at their phones and stuff like that. And
I'm not a millennial, so I don't have my phone
on me. All
right,
so two of the three panelists will be looking at their phones. We're also on CTN. The cameras of CTN are here, but we're not live. I don't know when it is that this will air, but consult your local CTN listings. I think we're on right after their new detective series, Loretti and Griebel, which is terrific, by the way. It's really good. You know? I love the car they have. Okay, so it's on the Wheelhouse page on Facebook. That's where you can find the Facebook Live. So get some excitement in your life. Watch this show, which is people sitting around talking about politics on TV, or at least on your computer. All right, so – or either one, really. All right, so back to the gubernatorial debates. And before we do that, let me just quickly mention that our guests today, our panelists, are Jonathan Wharton, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Urban Affairs at Southern Connecticut State University, Caitlin Krasselt, the intrepid political reporter at Hearst Connecticut Media, who fought the traffic all the way up here, and Russell Blair, reporter and content editor and content editor. He's very content on the Hartford Currents Metro desk. So we had another debate Monday night. It mainly consisted of a lot of finger pointing. But before we prejudge it, maybe we should listen to a clip or two. So do we have like a bunch of clips that are in sequence, Wolfie? Is that how it works? Yeah. So I wouldn't play them all at once. I would definitely just play one at a time. Go ahead. Here's the first one.
Ned Lamont will deliver Connecticut a third term of Dan Malloy. He's going to raise taxes. He's going to put up tolls. He's going to make bigger government and spend more, and he's going to introduce a statewide auto tax. Whether we're talking about affordable housing or education, what Ned doesn't understand is the best way to provide that for everyone is a better economy. And taxing and spending the people of Connecticut relentlessly, like we've done over the last 8 years, and he wants to continue, is not the way to provide the economic growth to help people. Now the plan is to only tax out-of-state heavy trucks. Does anybody in the audience honestly believe that if we go through the legislative process and the money to raise to put up tolls and all that's involved, that a year from now, every time you commute to work, you're not going to be hit with a toll? Of course he's going to put tolls back on the road. And we cannot afford it in this state anymore. Enough tax is enough.
All right. Those with the Golden Radio, a Stefanowski power sweep. You know, we're doing sort of the classic rock version of political coverage. So, Russell, we'll get to some Ned Lamont hits also as well. But I don't know. Tell us overall about this debate and whether it differed significantly from the previous one in New London.
I don't think we learned a whole lot more. You know, I was one of the people that was up there asking some of the questions. And what I thought was interesting was that, you know, Bob Stefanowski clearly got some good debate prep, because no matter what the question was, he was able to pivot it back to his issue, which is eliminating the state of the income tax. And, you know, his solution to everything, and you heard it in the second clip there, is, you know, quote unquote, we need a better economy. And you do that by cutting taxes. So I think, you know, in terms of judging who did well in the debate, I think he, you know, if you're looking at who stayed on message, he was on message the whole entire time there, talking about, you know, how do we have better schools? Well, you lower the taxes and, you know, that's going to bring in more money. How do you have better health care? Well, you know, lower the taxes and people have more money in their pockets. So no matter what the issue was, he found a way to go back to his campaign issue. And in some ways, I think Ned Lamont seemed a little frustrated, because the whole debate boiled down to, you know, Stefanowski saying, I'm going to get rid of the income tax. And then Ned Lamont is saying, no, he can't do that. Let me try to explain to you how he can't do that, which is hard to do in 90 seconds when the other guy can just go back and say, yes, I am going to do it. So,
yeah, I don't know. Jonathan?
I think the secret ingredient in all this, and you've seen the media pick this up, has been that Tim Herbst has been kind of behind the scenes helping him out and coaching him, the former candidate, the former Republican candidate. And, of course, he's pretty fierce in those debates, you might remember, over the summer and during the spring, especially since he's a lawyer. I think that's kind of the secret ingredient in all this. I even had a chance to speak with him before the debate, and Herbst is really on cloud nine these days, which is kind of rare for somebody like him, because he's pretty intense. It's like Christmas for him. He was really into this and helping to prep him and all that. So I did see kind of a shift, a bit of a pivot, if you will, with Stefanowski, you know, as you said, Colin, to get back on message about the taxes. But I also heard a lot of blowback from a lot of people telling me that that's all he's talking about this entire time. The economy here in Connecticut has been problematic for a very, very long time. And yet it seems like we're still stuck in the 90s in some ways with our economy. So he's really trying to bring out that you have to draw in more businesses and broaden out the economy by dealing with the tax issue in Connecticut.
Although, Caitlin, you know, I mean, it's always interesting even to consider what a debate is. And I think for some people it seems like a job interview. For other people, it is an attempt probably or an opportunity to for one candidate to directly impugn the motives, character and competence of an opponent. I mean, there's all kinds of things that go on in a debate. But you watch these debates or you listen to these debates, and, you know, being governor is pretty complicated. There's like a lot of stuff that you have to do. You look at the last 8 years of Dan Malloy, and he's had to address all kinds of problems, and he's chosen to address all kinds of other problems. And these debates really do seem to be boiling down to who can cut taxes more or claim they're going to cut taxes more, whether Ned can get people to understand that what Stefanowski is saying, you know, isn't really practical, and then just sort of a lot of finger pointing and nasty comments and jabs. I mean, I'm starting to wonder whether these debates have any capacity to inform anybody about who they should vote for.
I've wondered that too, because I go to a lot of these and they just say the same thing every time. And even to the point that, you know, Tim Herbst is in coaching Bob Stefanowski, you hear Bob Stefanowski say things that Tim Herbst said in debates before the primary. And it's like, oh, that sounds familiar. So I wonder sometimes how much value there is in having these guys just kind of go at each other. And I think that's where the argument to have the other candidates, the Oz Griebel and the Libertarian candidate, Rod, I think is his name. There is an argument to let them be on the debate stage because there has been cases in the past that have proven if you add a third person, it's less of a back and forth finger pointing. They actually get more into the issues because they don't want to gang up on each other. It looks bad.
Yeah. You know, this is something that I meant to say like a couple of weeks ago when I was a panelist instead of a guest host, but I'll say it now anyway. Polling is a really bad qualifier for whether people should be on a debate stage or not. Polling was never intended to be that. If you were to ask, I think, most data scientists, most people who do polls, is that a good way to use a poll to determine whether somebody gets to be at a debate? I think the responsible ones would say no. A poll is a snapshot of a specific moment, you know, where, and it's also weighted, you know, for all kinds of indices. I mean, you know, in these cases, with Oz Griebel getting 4% and with, you know, the other two, Hanscom and Mark Stewart Greenstein getting essentially zero, I mean, the polls are kind of discouraging. But you kind of – I don't know. Russell, now that you've been up on that stage with those two guys, I don't know if you could imagine – I don't think you can just cherry pick Oz. I think, you know, everybody who's on the ballot has to be up there if you're going to let people up there. I mean, would it have been better or worse? I don't know.
One of the arguments that Oz Griebel has made is that in the Quinnipiac poll, a majority of people said they didn't know enough about him to form an opinion whether they supported him or not. So his argument is, look, if people don't know enough about me to say whether or not they support me, I should be included in the debate. And I believe he is going to be in a debate next week. I think we got that yesterday that UConn is doing a debate, and I think he's going to be included in that one. And I think Caitlin makes a good point that if you have a third person in there, it can't just be two people going back and forth, you know, because Griebel could pick up on something that Lamont says. He could pick up on something that Stefanowski says. You do run the risk of, you know, potentially, I guess he could be ignored completely. But I think that it would change the dynamic. And I think, you know, it's a pretty significant barrier to get on the ballot in Connecticut. You have to go out and you have to get 7,500 signatures of registered voters. You need, you know, 169 sheets of paper on a clipboard. I was actually talking to Mark Stewart Greenstein after the debate this week, and he was, you know, explaining to me how he had it down to where he only needed to have, I think, four different clipboards when he walked around to all these supermarkets and things like that. But you know, it's a process. So I think if you're on the ballot, if you're somebody that you know, voters are going to have a choice to vote for, you know, I think there's a good argument that you should be included in the debate. I can understand an organizer, you know, getting worried that if you have five people up there, it could get a little hectic. But, you know, look at what we saw in 2016 with the primary debates where you had, you know, on the Republican side, 15 people on stage. So I think you can handle five.
Nothing went wrong there.
We had the same problem with the primaries with the Republicans and Democrats this spring.
Yeah, just a couple of months
right?
ago. Yeah.
I mean, I'll be frank with you. I'm against it. I'm the complete opposite. I think that the presence of the two-big-party system is here, whether we like it or not. And, you know, 21% we're holding on with the Republicans and clearly double that, at least for the Democrats. But you know one thing? That matters because they are the ones who made the decisions. They have the people who registered for the party affiliation. These independents and others who are out there, we don't know who they are. And we saw that at these independent conventions. I mean, a lot of people didn't even know that they're independent and they had these conventions. They could have been invited, included, to make a decision of who could be the candidate that they didn't be endorsed. But they don't know. There's no real organization or structure.
Just to clarify what he's saying, there's something called the Independent Party.
Thank you.
Which a lot of people don't understand. Sometimes they register as independents. They think they're registering unaffiliated. They actually belong to a party if mm-hmm. they sign up for something called independent. But anyway, yeah.
Thank you for the clarification. Yeah.
Well, you know, let me just, for the sake of argument, push back at that and say, I understand everything that you're saying. I think it's a very cogent argument. On the other hand, you know, I mean, these debates are not bearing fruit. I mean, we're having these kind of primitive conversations. Wow, Stefanowski stayed on message and pivoted away from every single question about anything else except what he felt like talking about. What Ned seems to be trying to do is a little bit too complicated for the structure of the debates. And they're spending a lot of time just snipping at each other and being the Bickersons. So if the debates suck, you know, to use a political science term.
I never use that in class, but I'll take it.
Yeah, why not change up the lineup so maybe we get a more substantive conversation?
I think, well, I'm going to point the fingers at the media. Uh-oh, Russell, uh-oh. Watch out.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. I know. He was up there on stage. You know, pick out better questions then to actually make it go to the point about policy. I mean, look, I'm a policy junkie 100%. The questions have got to be formulated and be direct and make certain that they're pointing to specific examples.
But they don't answer them anyway. They pivot.
Then guess what? The journalists should do their job and go after them further.
All right. So well, on that note.
As a non-journalist, I'm kind of picking right. at everybody in the room here.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I think we'll take a break right now. Actually, yesterday in his cybersecurity press conference, Dan Malloy channeled Jonathan Wharton and started picking on the press. So we might mention that as well when we come back. All right. I'm back. I'm Colin McEnroe, guest hosting today. I'm usually a panelist, or I don't know what I am. But John Dankosky is at a two-week Renaissance fair in Spain where he is a wizard. And Mrs. Dankosky recently won the second place in the women's jousting. So meanwhile, The Wheelhouse is produced by Scott Breedy. Confusingly, not that confusingly, but one of our new interns just started today, and her name is Penina Beattie and Scott Breedy. And our executive producer is Katie Talarski, which is not really quite the same thing. Kion Wolf is the technical producer. Senior producer of the Colin McEnroe Show is Betsy Kaplan, but she kind of gets involved in everything. I guarantee you she did something today with this thing. And Carlos Mejia is our technical guru and the one to thank for us being live on Facebook, live. I also want to quickly mention that today on our show, we're doing a show, I don't even know how to describe it, because we sort of came up with this idea that didn't really exist and then kind of filled it up with guests. We're calling them apocaloptimists. These are writers and poets and people like that who acknowledge that we're in a really difficult time with climate change and a very disrupted political climate. One wrong tweet to Korea could send the whole thing up in smoke. But they find ways to mine human experience and the acts of love and creation while acknowledging all the problems that we face. And so we're going to have a conversation about a genre that didn't exist until we made it up. All right. So here we go. Back to The Wheelhouse and back to our fine panel here. Jonathan Wharton, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Urban Affairs at Southern Connecticut State University. Caitlin Krasalt, political reporter at Hearst Connecticut Media. Russell Blair, reporter on the Hartford – no, he's not. He's content and content editor. I just read whatever's here even if I know better on the Hartford Currents Metro Desk. So this wasn't really necessarily in our emails, but I think this is something we can talk about really briefly, which is, you know, Caitlin, it was a matter of time before Dan Malloy got tired of hearing both candidates disavow him and just talk about, you know, how you're Dan Malloy. No, I'm not Dan Malloy. I ran against Dan Malloy. You're more Dan Malloy than I am. No, you're Dan Malloy. So Dan Malloy yesterday, who actually is Dan Malloy, by the way, was talking about cybersecurity. But he also just started to talk back a little bit. First of all, say a lot of things about his accomplishments in economic development and reshaping the state are getting either reported incorrectly or at least the press is just echoing what various candidates are saying without really fact-checking it. Your colleague at Hearst, Ken Dixon, wrote a really interesting column, I thought, just sort of saying, you know, if you want a governor who can address multifarious problems, and he listed a whole bunch of them. He goes, you actually have one, but he's leaving. And it is kind of interesting. Ultimately, as part of this campaign, you sort of wonder whether this default acceptance of the idea that Dan Malloy is an example of a bad governor can stay in place the way it is right now.
Yeah. Ken, I really enjoyed Ken's column because I'm not from here. And so it was fun to learn a lot of things about Dan Malloy I didn't know and have that historical context. I feel bad for him because I don't think his inbox was treated well after that column ran. Yeah, I think he brought up a really good point where, you know, Dan Malloy, for some reason, is very unpopular, and there's reasons for that. But people forget all of the good things that have happened under him, and will those things continue? I don't know.
Russell, I mean, he did blame some of this on the press. It is true that compared to, like, when I was a Harvard Current state capitol reporter, a dark period in the history of the Hartford Current and state capital reporting in general. I mean, there are just a lot more people up there. There are a lot more people. You could maybe do a little bit more in-depth stuff. He thinks that's the reason. I'm not sure that's the case because there are still terrific political journalists, many of whom participate on the Wheelhouse in this state. But you do sort of wonder, like, at some point whether there have to be more pieces like the Dixon piece, just examining that latent idea, Dan Malloy equals bad.
I think it's hard to look at someone's legacy when you're, you know, in the middle of him leaving and you know, he does have a very low approval rating, and, you know, in the Quinnipiac poll and other public polls that have done. But I think, you know, Ken's raised a lot of good points. And I think, you know, when we look back, you know, 8 years from now or 10 years from now, you know, at some of the things that he did, I mean, you know, you did have a governor that went into labor and got them to agree to make some givebacks. You know, you could argue that it wasn't enough or that there should have been more. Certainly there were tax increases, but you know, there was a huge deficit that had to be closed. And what would the alternative have been? I know that, you know, early on in the administration, I think they called it, you know, the Plan B budget or something like that. And it was essentially, you know, if we don't raise taxes, here's the other options. We don't know how truthful that was, but it was, you know, closing DMVs. It was scaling back education programs, you know, childcare for young kids. So, you know, I think that, you know, in some ways, you know, maybe the governor is doing his job correctly if he's, you know, getting a lot of people angry at him. You know, you could argue that he's, you know, his whole thing was, you know, the shared sacrifice. You know, I know some people, you know, feel like that really wasn't the case. But, you know, you look across state government and, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, good things that have been done. There's some, you know, social policies that have been passed that, you know, people are very supportive of. So I think it's hard to look at somebody's legacy and kind of assess it, you know, in the now. I think, you know, 10 years from now, we'll have a better idea of, you know, exactly how good of a governor was Dan Malloy. And you see the same thing with presidents a lot of times. It takes some time for them to be gone to sort of go back and look and see what exactly they got done.
Yeah, I just, you know, Jonathan, you probably have a different perspective on this.
I do.
Which is good.
Very much.
Well, actually, let's just hear your different perspective.
Sure. I mean, I will say this. I mean, because my students have often challenged me about this. You know, what is it with this image problem that Malloy has? And I've had the same debates also with Chris Christie, you know, discussing this with my students as well, because I have a lot of students from New Jersey who say the same thing. What is it that these executive leaders get all this attention and negativity in their term? Yeah, part of it is an image problem, a part of it is an ego problem, but a bigger problem of it are the voters and the people that get polled. My professor at Rutgers University, God bless Alan Rosenthal, who died a few years ago, he studied governors over and over again. He's written multiple books on it. And he says, and it's a good reality, voters and people who get polled blame the executive leader. They know the name. It's easy to point to. They don't know their state, you know, officials in their state house. So, you know one thing? Can you point your finger at the problems with the budget related to your state senator or your state house rep? You probably don't know who they are. So this has been done over and over again. It's easy to point the blame at the executive leader. We see the same thing at the local level. Easy to blame the mayor. We see the same thing at the federal level. Easy to blame the president. Trump, Obama, take your pick. But can you remember who your legislative officials are that got us in the mess in the first place?
Likely, right. No.
Although, Jonathan, I just want to follow up with one thing, which is that, I mean, per Ken Dixon's column and other things as well, many of the things that candidates are running on right now, downsizing state government, for example, and reshaping pensions. I mean, Malloy did take two cracks at the pensions. We can argue about, you know, whether he did enough, whether he got enough in terms of concessions and stuff like that. I think I'm trying to remember from Ken's article, there's like 12,000 fewer state employees. And this is after 10 years of John Rowland privatizing as much of the state workforce as he possibly could,
too. And buying them out.
Yeah. And you sort of wonder, like, how much is left to squeeze out of this lemon in any kind of conventional way.
Well, and the thing is that the unions are very good at organizing and doing what they do here in Connecticut. I mean, you know, as somebody who is a state employee firsthand, and I see this, and of course, conveniently, my state senator is also, you know, my union rep. it is classic politics here. They're very good at organizing and doing what they do. And I've seen it firsthand as a former Republican chairman in New Haven. You see how they have a stranglehold on a city like New Haven. The majority of the alders are union leaders. So they're good at what they do. I have no question. I mean, God forbid if I ever challenge them in a parking lot, I will die. And I've tried doing it publicly. It's difficult, Colin, to be fair. I can't imagine what it is for the leaders here in Hartford to try to challenge and deal with them. They're so organized. They have the money. They have the reputation.
So, Caitlin, to Jonathan's earlier point, I mean, there is, and if you talk to Republican legislative leaders in moments of frankness, they'll sort of almost admit that, you know, one possible good outcome from their point of view might be if some Democrat, these conversations for me anyway happened much earlier in the process, but if some Democrat were to become governor, because, you know, there aren't going to be any easy fixes, there's going to be tons of pain, everybody's going to be mad at everybody else, and they could somehow or other get control of the legislature, then they would be happy campers in some ways, you know, that just as Jonathan says, governors take all the blame, nobody knows who the legislators are, so it would be fun from their point of view to have a Republican speaker, Republican President pro tem in the Senate, you know, and do some of the stuff that they want and not worry so much about who the governor is.
I think that's a really good point. The governor's job is the job that no one really wants, right? Like for that exact reason, because it's not easy. You have a lot of hard decisions to make, and even the decisions that you don't make, you get blamed for.
Right. And so as we end here, let's end with something really exciting. Let's go out, you know, so that CTN's ratings will go up. Let's end with something really crackling with excitement. And of course, Russell, I'm talking about Ben Barnes. So Ben Barnes, who's been the budget director for Dan Malloy. One of the questions is, like, what's going to happen to all the Malloy appointees afterwards? Many of them have already climbed into life rafts and are going someplace else. Ben Barnes, who in my mind will forever be associated with the phrase, a permanent state of fiscal crisis, which I always thought was kind of a less inspiring term than he might have chosen. But he's up for a financial position in the state university system. I'm sure Jonathan will want to have the last word about that particular thing. But you sort of wonder about the optics of that, too. You know, I mean, now Lamont is going to be judged on any Malloy development. You guys have a big story about pork in the bond commission today. Like, everything that comes up like that is going to get run through this Stefanowski rifle barrel right at Malloy.
No, I think, you know, a key thing to be looking out for now, certainly with the election coming up, everyone's focused on that. But also, you know, where are the Malloy people going? You know, are they're getting shuffled around in many cases to other jobs in state government so that they can reach the 10 years that they need to get pensions and health care and things like that. And also, you know, you talked about the pork, you know, the bond commission. There's only a couple of agendas left for Malloy. So now we're starting to see, you know, who's getting what projects are getting funded before he leaves office. We talked about earlier off mic the grocery store in Hartford. You know, that's something that Governor Stefanowski is probably not going to want to borrow state money for. So we're seeing a lot of projects like that.
But maybe the handball court he wants. I forget where the handball court is.
I think Manchester.
Manchester.
So, there you go. That might be a Stefanowski priority.
Got to have a handball court in Manchester.
You can lobby for it.
Yeah. So, Jonathan, you will have the last word. Ben Barnes, the budget director, kind of heading over towards your neck of the woods. He's just a candidate for this finance job, right?
It's not surprising that this kind of thing is taking place, as Russell's mentioning. You see this in a lot of administrations. They're merely taking advantage of the spoils system, the appointment system within the state government. And this is not unusual in Connecticut. You see this in many states. Mm-hmm. I also want to say that you see something like Ojakian, for example, who obviously has been heading, obviously, that commission too. So, you know, and he was
obviously with the he was the chief of staff for the governor. So it's not unusual you see this kind of shuffle taking place among these candidates.
Right. You have a choice: the revolving door, where they go and take all their expertise and their connections into the private sector and leverage all kinds of private sector high salaries in order to affect the very government they used to serve in, or they can do this other thing where they just stay in the federal the state government and get whatever they can. All right, we got a lot out of this wonderful panel today, so thanks very much to Russell and Caitlin and Jonathan. Thanks to everybody else who helped out. Thanks to our friends at CTN. Remember to watch Griebel and Loretti. It's a spellbinding detective series, and they're bare-knuckled guys who don't play by the rules.